stemmed from the administration performing a simple status check rather than any disturbing findings. I promise you a thorough and detailed report in the coming days, free from any political filter or other undue influence. More whispers floated through the room, gathering momentum until the collective voices reached a crescendo that caused Ayam to call for order. Through it all, Obi-Wan maintained a straight, stoic posture, though he called out to the Force, gauging the emotions swirling throughout the space.
"We understand that you are still gathering data," Ayam said. "However, further evidence has recently come to our attention."
Suddenly, the mood in the room shifted, a palpable change that led Obi-Wan to accept that the worst may have indeed happened, and he would have to react accordingly to preserve any chance of peace. He simply nodded at the minister's statement, his eyes scanning the room, when several clicks echoed through the space. The door behind the podiums slid open, revealing two figures, Keetar and Ventress, but not Rug.
"Because this evidence,"
Keetar said, a ferocity to his words, "clearly shows that the Jedi Emissary has not been completely honest with us."
He walked in, a small folded cloth in his hands. Everyone in the room turned, angling this way or that to get a look at the cloth, but Obi-Wan already knew. He knew from the unblinking glare on Keetar's face, from the smug derision on Ventress's lips. He knew because the message had stared right at him from the floor of his quarters, a message in the form of broken pieces, only possible via precise cuts from a lightsaber. Whose lightsaber, he still didn't know. But as Obi-Wan met Ventress's look under her hood, his suspicion grew.
"While this Jedi Knight,"
Keetar started, a derisive mockery in the word,
"was among us, I knew something was not correct. After all, doesn't the Republic have a long history of treating Neimoidians as second-class citizens, as walking transactions and nothing else? So why would this be any different?"
He unfolded the cloth in his palm, plucking out the missing comlink resting on top of the data pad Obi-Wan had recovered on the surface.
Keetar held them up high, one device in each hand. "Deception is the way of the Republic," he said, his voice so piercing it sparked an uproar.
Ayam stood, arms waving to calm the commotion that had overtaken the space. But just as the noise began to settle, Ventress spoke up.
"We've found the Jedi's secret bunker on the surface," she said, activating a hollow projection of the structure he'd visited.
Images cycled through until it stopped on a close-up of the door. Specifically, the lightsaber burns on the hinges.
"In my time working with Count Dooku, I have come to recognize the mark of a Jedi's weapon. He did, after all, leave the Order because of concerns of corruption. And this," she gestured at the image, "is clear evidence of Obi-Wan Kenobi trying to seal off the bunker."
Which, of course, wasn't the purpose of the burn, but Obi-Wan knew such a clarification meant little right now. The visual was enough to identify his presence, regardless of truth.
"And why would he hide such things? Why would he..."
The image switched and showed the bunker as a burnt-out ashen shell.
"Burn such a structure. Clearly, to destroy the evidence."
With that, Keetar held up the data pad and comlink again, except this time each activated. First, the data pad projected a hologram of information, side-by-side comparisons between bomb details forensically pieced together and schematics of Republic bombs used by the clones. Then the comlink played audio for everyone to hear.
Obi-Wan, where are you?
Anakin's voice came out.
I've just sent you the findings. It looks bad for the Republic. The information on the datapad is authentic. It's real.
I can't explain, Obi-Wan said. I understand what this looks like, but you must listen to me. I want the same thing you do. I want peace and I want truth. Please give me more time.
But his words had no effect on the audience. The technicalities that the bunker already existed, that the datapad was already there, that communications went to Anakin on Langston and not the Jedi Council on Coruscant, none of that mattered. The optics were well against him. Keetar and Ventress simply needed an opening.
So this Jedi, Ventress said, comes to your world, violates your rules, hides the evidence you so desperately seek, and then transmits it to the Republic. He has not just broken trust. He has smashed it to pieces, then swept it away.
Keetar walked in front of the officials, still holding up the two devices.
We're fortunate that the Confederacy sent Asajj Ventress to oversee the Jedi emissary. Without her, who knows what he might have gotten away with?
The room gave way to shouting words and fingers pointed at Obi-Wan with a distinct fury where anything presented by Keetar and Ventress amplified the raw pain of Kevisura. I am shouted everyone down, then stood up.
The emissary of the Republic has been charged with hiding evidence and violating the conditions of his stay during a catastrophic time. As such, the minister said, he will be tried for his crimes in the great theater of judgment, open to the air and mist for all of Cato Neimoidia, for all of the galaxy to see. Guards?
Six guards marched in from the back entrance, Rug among them. Obi-Wan looked at her, and while most of the guards wore stoic determination, Rug's mouth and eyes showed creases of concern.
Should he be found guilty, the emissary's punishment will be swift. Until that time, he will be detained.
Iam took in a breath and gauged the room. Keetar continued to glower, a spark ready to ignite at a moment's notice. Ventress watched with cool detachment, arms crossed in a frozen pose. As for Rug, the worry on her face grew with each passing second. Was it for Obi-Wan? Was it for her people? Was it for the galaxy, whose gears were about to turn yet again?
Obi-Wan Kenobi, Jedi Knight, emissary of the Republic, let it be declared here, you are an enemy of the state.
Iam stood and flicked his wrist forward.
Guards, take him away.
Chapter 29. Anakin Skywalker.
The clones complied with every request. They didn't bother to ask why Anakin wanted additional medical supplies or access to a shuttle. Instead, he got a simple,
"Yes, sir,"
followed by a quick departure to retrieve the crates, stopping only to answer Mill's question about whether the additional supplies would be missed.
We always load in excess of 3 to 5% of materials in case anything is lost or damaged on the way,
the trooper explained, which worked for both of their purposes, and he even pointed to one of the 4 Ada-class shuttles sitting unused in the docking bay.
Whichever one you prefer, General.
No explanations, no justifications. A simple chain of command, one that left him with countless troops ready to do whatever he deemed necessary. The sheer number of possibilities exploded through Anakin's mind. The temptation of simply getting whatever he wanted done. but that quickly became tempered with a discipline, one that reminded him where his responsibilities lay. Padme, the Chancellor, Obi-Wan, the Jedi, the Republic. Though after Padme, things shifted around based on situations, pushing him one way or the other. In many cases, they all aligned. Padme, after all, was a key member of the Senate, which worked with the Jedi and for the Republic. Prioritizing one often trickled down to all of them. Even now, with this makeshift plan, it all chained together. If he went to be Obi-Wan's backup, it might assist in Obi-Wan's goal of de-escalating the war. If the war was de-escalated, then the Republic would be safer. If the Republic was safer, then the Jedi would be needed less, and the Senate would have fewer emergency sessions. And if those things happened, then Anakin and Padme would have fewer things trying to pull them apart. Really, that was all that mattered. Galactic peace, Obi-Wan's safety, Palpatine stability, all of those things were important. But when layer by layer was stripped away, the only thing that truly mattered to Anakin's Sun Dragon heart was Padme. He would do anything to protect her, even if that meant shifting the entire axis of the galaxy. Or in this case, going to help Obi-Wan on Cato Neimoidia, because someone had gotten their hands on the most important data in the galaxy. The clone returned, the blinking lights of the launch bay reflecting off the gray stripes painted across his helmet. He gestured to the three supply crates on the now deactivated repulsor lift dolly, then walked away when Anakin dismissed him. R2-D2 rolled slowly up to the inventory, then beeped a comment that roughly came across as, "Do I have to carry all of that?" Mill looked at the droid quizzically, and Anakin offered a quick translation before replying. "Some of it, but I'll need you for something more important." R2-D2, in fact, did not carry any of the storage crates. But the astromech droid did pull the repulsor lift platform beneath the three boxes of medical supplies. They walked through the broken neighborhoods of Langston's mining district, a cluster of domed buildings designed to work with the heavy winds at the base of the nearest mountain. Signs of a civilization that had thrived just a few weeks ago before the separatists decided to make it a battleground. Wisps of blue sand blew, causing a thin veil of color to come and go, enough for Anakin to bury his gloved mechanical hand under his cloak. His eyes, his hair, he was used to sand and that. But the joints and gears that were now part of his body, those needed protecting. Decades of architecture and infrastructure had been transformed into mounds of rubble and half-standing buildings. Walls had complete chunks missing due to rockets or blaster fire. And while Mill's demeanor reset itself during their short time back on the ship, she took tentative steps, a strained look on her face in the form of thin lips and concerned eyes. Mill led the way quietly, allowing Anakin to take in the scene, the multi-species population showing a combination of resolve, fatigue, and despair. Anakin saw it from the younglings playing blitzball on the nearby lake to the elder Aqualish sitting in the remaining doorway arch of an otherwise vaporized building. And if he saw it, then Mill must have sensed it as well.
"Look at this."
She broke free from their pace, then ran over to a pile of debris, a mix of dented stone and twisted beams, all marred by the blackened scars of blaster fire.
"Do you see it?"
Anakin caught up to her, still uncertain about what caught her attention.
"Even here, with all this."
Mill spread her arms wide.
"Life can grow."
She pulled several pieces of jagged debris out of a rubble mound, much of it already covered in a layer of Langston sand. The chunks rolled to the ground and settled, and Mill blew the remaining sand away to clear off the space.
"There,"
she said, a single wildflower now visible. It reacted with a sensitivity greater than most flowers Anakin had seen, its petals tilting upward as they encountered the sun's beams. A little bit of help. She turned, catching Anakin's sudden grin.
What?
Clones don't look for flowers, huh?
They probably don't. But it's not that.
Anakin gestured at Mill to keep leading the way, thinking of Padme putting a flower in her hair just nights ago, and wondering if she'd kept it or if it had already withered away. I know someone who would appreciate this. That's all. He pointed over the horizon, a path opening into a wide thoroughfare for the community. Should we start asking around? Anakin asked. A practical question, but also something to distract Mill from her obvious queasiness. The town spaceport is over there. There were a few local craft sitting around. He dragged his finger across a nearby wall, a layer of sand coming off onto his black glove. Probably covered in dust.
No, Mill said. We should keep going.
R2-D2 complained, but Anakin motioned for him to settle down. Don't tell me you're getting tired. He laughed at the droid's sassy reply. What do you mean a long walk? We don't even know. Anakin stopped and watched Mill. And though the youngling carried the burden of being affected by everything she felt around them, she walked with purpose, turning immediately down a smaller alley. Hey, Mill. We're in a business district, Anakin said, catching up to her. Plenty of shopkeepers here who probably own a ship for one reason or another. Why don't we just announce ourselves?
Because they need these supplies.
Mill, we can't help everyone we encounter. That's just not practical. And I really need to get going. The young Zabrak turned, a sudden fierceness in her eyes. She suddenly looked taller, and her jawline clenched with a burst of confidence. In that moment, Anakin saw so much of a reflection in her, not just of his instinctive, stubborn pull to his own moral compass, but also of Padme's ability to both empathize and be pragmatic about it. One look told him who they were.
Rokura and her siblings lost their elders in the attack. They need something to get by without the family business. I don't know if they'll use these supplies. Maybe they'll barter them.
Mill turned and resumed walking, each stride picking up the pace.
But this'll help. Shouldn't we give them that? After what's happened to them?
Anakin turned skyward with a sigh. Exasperation, but also a hint of amusement slipping in. R2-D2 chirped back a "What are you waiting for?" series of beeps, and Anakin shot the droid a look.
Yes, R2, he said, patting the rolling droid on the head. I know she's right.
R2-D2 squawked again, almost as if the droid laughed at him. Then he whistled, a question in electronic form.
Yeah, I agree. Padme would like her too.
The transaction took longer than Anakin would have liked, given the circumstances, but he quickly saw that Mill made the correct call. The supplies now with the group of Garrel siblings, Anakin powered up their family ship, an ancient hyperdrive-capable dynamic-class freighter called the Noriker, formerly used for hauling select bins of Langston's rarest ores, small purchases for specialized manufacturing. But now the ship sat idle. Two generations of the family killed in crossfire and collateral damage, leaving it to become a rental by barter craft for a Jedi Knight on an unauthorized mission. Mill waved goodbye to a limping Rokura, then met with Anakin as he ran a diagnostic check. They know I'll return it as soon as I can?
They do. They also said to take your time. No one's flying anywhere right now.
Hopefully, Anakin said, looking at the readouts on the panels for power balance among speed, shields, and auxiliary operations.
This will be over in just a day or two. I'd much prefer that.
R2-D2 chimed in with a sarcastic comment about needing some downtime, and Anakin refused to dignify that with a response. "As for you," he said, "call Theo from the shuttle and tell him that I've gone to investigate something. They'll send a pilot to bring you and the shuttle back to the cruiser. You do know your way back, right?"
"That's not necessary, Master."
"Why's that?" Anakin asked, running initial diagnostics on the hyperdrive's energy stabilizer. "Durbin will make sure you get back to the temple soon."
"Because I'm coming with you."
He stopped toggling the switches and swiveled his chair around.
"Excuse me?"
This is why he'd never, ever considered dealing with a Padawan. He knew how stubborn they were. That was him mere months ago.
"Master, I would rather do something that might bring an end to the war instead of digging for kyber crystals."
"The gathering is much more than just getting a kyber crystal. It's,
I know. I've heard the Padawan say you find yourself on Ilum. I don't care. The other younglings want weapons, adventure and fighting, big jumps. You're going somewhere that might put an end to the war."
"Kadone Moidia is no place for a youngling. Not right now."
"And how do you know that?"
she asked, hands now squarely on hips.
"Because,"
Anakin said, ducking underneath the control panel. He pretended to check wiring, but really, it was to buy time to come up with an answer.
"It's a tense political situation. Why do we do this? Are we just swinging a lightsaber and lifting boxes? Or are we building peace?"
She got down on his level, determined scowl now face to face with him under the console.
"Peace across the galaxy. Peace in yourself. You asked me if I wanted to help people. Well, that's what I'm going to do. With you."
Her words echoed a memory. So many years ago, when Qui-Gon Jinn told him to stay in the cockpit of a starfighter as the Naboo attempted to take back their planet from the Trade Federation. Of course, he kept his word about staying in the cockpit.
"Qui-Gon told me to stay in this cockpit, and that's what I'm going to do," he'd told R2-D2 at the time,
with the same conviction Millie used now. And he'd kept his word, all while doing what he thought was right. What his heart told him to do in order to help the people he quickly grew to care about. He'd stayed in the cockpit. It was the surroundings that changed as he flew into space.
"I'm not changing your mind, am I?"
he asked. Mill sat down in the Noriker's passenger seat, then adjusted the ponytail behind her horns.
"Not a chance."
Chapter 30, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Everything slowed around Obi-Wan, a trick of the Force to accelerate the way his mind processed the situation. He blinked, his eyes closed for a fraction of a second, yet enough for thoughts to ripple through his mind as he considered the options before him. 6 guards approached, each with standard rifles, except Roog, who apparently was allowed to use her configurable sniper rifle, the barrel withdrawn into a shorter range module for closer combat. Keetar and Ventress held their positions, the young Neimoidian still with Anakin's comm link and the incriminating datapad. The officials, both in front of him and in the audience behind him, stayed seated, though all gave off a palpable tension. His lightsaber hung on a guard's belt behind him. That part didn't bother him. The rest, given all of his training with both a lightsaber and the Force, and really, the two represented a single intertwined flow, a pure combat situation here would not be that difficult. And the situation played right into one of his favorite fighting techniques. There'd been worse, and Obi-Wan figured that even this collective group of guards failed to match the threat of, say, the bounty hunter Jango Fett with his arsenal of Mandalorian weapons and tools. Roog had specialized training, of course. The rest, though?
just guards. Should it come to violence, he felt confident in his abilities. But he had a different goal than simply defeating an opponent. His entire purpose here was to clear the Republic's name and lobby the Trade Federation away from neutrality. Perhaps not into complete alignment with the Republic, but at least to a level where economic sanctions against the Separatists were on the table. Such a discussion had already been a long shot, and the recent revelations made it far more challenging. Using his lightsaber to deal with guards would make it impossible. And then there was Ventress. Was she the one with the lightsabers? How did she factor into all of this? Had it just been the guards, Obi-Wan might have decided to simply put his hands up, relinquish his lightsaber, and strategize a plan from that. But given the unknown variable of someone, Ventress or not, capable of wielding such a specialized weapon, that raised far too many questions to surrender on the spot. Any threat with lightsaber skills meant that protecting his lightsaber was his top non-diplomatic priority. And his only option here was to do his best at imitating Anakin Skywalker. He needed to improvise. Obi-Wan opened his eyes, each of his moves playing out with specific purpose. First, he called his lightsaber to his hand, its blue blade erupting from the hilt. As expected, the guards readied their rifles. Next, he waited. Someone had to take the first shot, and only seconds passed before it came. Not from one of the guards, and definitely not from Roog. The first shot came from Kitar, who had dropped the devices and drawn his pistol. His eyes flared as the bolt exploded out of the gun, a bright red that only intensified the color of his eyes. That was all Obi-Wan needed. Next, he shifted the angle of his lightsaber, tilting it slightly in anticipation. With the bolt less than a meter away, his arms tensed, muscles coiling up before releasing with a small and direct push forward. The bolt impacted the lightsaber, a pressure driving against the weapon before kinetically redirected. A confluence of velocity and angle that led the burst of energy into an entirely new direction. The bolt soared through the room, flying between the helmets of two guards to directly impact the control panel of the back door. It tore through the panel's outer covering and circuitry, ending with a brilliant spray of sparks. A contained sprinkle of fireworks that petered out into glowing debris falling to the floor. The door slid open, its locking mechanism destroyed. Two of the guards turned to face the now open exit, and while Rue kept her rifle trained on Obi-Wan, she didn't fire. Kitar took several more shots, which Obi-Wan deflected into the safest areas possible. The immaculate masonry of the room would have to be collateral damage here. Ventress, though, still didn't move. Obi-Wan gave himself to the Force, and his body rode the ensuing wave, legs and arms moving infinitely faster than their normal pace. He ran and vaulted over the front podiums and landed in motion before slipping between the guards. And though each of them focused on the spot where he used to be, even Roog, Obi-Wan thought he caught the corner of Ventress's eye, a simple tracking glance as he crossed the door threshold. Halfway down the hall, he returned to normal speed, still moving at an athletic pace, but now clear of immediate danger. The first part of his ad hoc plan was met. He'd escaped the room to safety without hurting anyone. But now... "Go, go, go!" a voice cried out. It might have been Kitar, though Obi-Wan wasn't sure. In fact, he wasn't sure where to actually go. Curious bystanders started to peer down the hallway, office workers and government employees of all kinds. He ran at normal speed, attentive to the way overexertion of the Force's physical gifts might affect anything from strength to coordination. The way the Force surrounded him as he moved informed his decisions and calculations. An extra burst down the long hall was feasible, but doing so might briefly drain him.
No. Right now, he needed to rely on his own body, at least until an opportunity presented itself.
I'm on the target,
another voice yelled. That one was distinctive.
Stand back. Give me a clear shot.
Rogue. Which Obi-Wan guessed meant she'd switched her rifle to sniper mode and zeroed it in on him. He stretched out with the force one more time, not for any physical gifts of strength or speed, but to slow the world down and appraise the situation. Directly in front of him, civilians stood in the hallway, many shrinking back from the reality of the scene. Around him was a tunnel. The tunnel may have had elegant carvings in the walls, lines of shiny minerals embedded into subtle carvings amid the bleached white stone. But regardless of aesthetics, the hallway remained nothing but a tunnel with a start and an end. To his right, though, were a series of windows open to overlook the massive courtyard Minister Ayam had called the Grand Theater of Judgment, an open-air arena of sorts. But more important, adjacent to it, several more nondescript buildings farther into the complex, places less exposed to public view. Those buildings had flat ledges and rooftops between the spires and slopes of Caton Amodia's architecture. That would help. Getting there required a precise leap at an exact angle to grip onto the buildings hanging down from the arch above, something that tapped into the way the force augmented a body's natural ability to leap. He considered the current placement of all the beings around him, from the guards behind to the civilians in front. A force-assisted burst of speed right now might leave his body exhausted, unable to tap into what he needed to scale such heights. However, Rogue had her sniper rifle trained on him, and Obi-Wan was pretty sure that as someone who'd earned her grizzled weariness and commando armor, she didn't miss her shots. That left a choice. Trust his body's capabilities under duress, or trust Rogue. Time snapped back into reality, and he dashed forward, lightsaber blade drawn back into its hilt, and took one quick glance back. While Rogue had one eye in her scope, the other eye shut for focus, he sensed her reactions, her purpose, her inner moral compass. There was no conflict in Rogue. She knew exactly what she was doing. Obi-Wan trusted that her certainty came from the right place.
Shoot the Jedi!
Keitar screamed, his voice cracking.
Shoot him now!
Blaster bolts rang out, though without the boom of a sniper rifle. Obi-Wan knew the fire came from the muzzle of a pistol, not Rogue's specialized weapon.
Stand down, Keitar! Rogue yelled. There are civilians in the way!
About 20 paces remained until he reached the open window. 19, 18, 17. Each step came with precise measurements, an internal calculation both physically to get him there and mentally gambling on Rogue's decision.
I've got a line of sight, she said, her voice projecting far enough for Obi-Wan to hear everything.
10, 9, 8. Obi-Wan took one last look behind him. The force rippled around him, and Obi-Wan put his faith in it. And in Rogue.
5, 4, 3.
Obi-Wan's angle shifted enough to prepare his body to leap. He felt the force surrounding him like an ocean current and also powering the physical response within the fibers of his muscles. The sniper rifle erupted, a fraction of a second later than it should have, at least if Rogue had intended on killing her target. Instead, her extra breath gave Obi-Wan the exact amount of time he needed to leap out the large open window, the rifle bolt whizzing right below his feet as he ascended.
No!
As the force pushed Obi-Wan's flight, Keitar's voice trailed him. Obi-Wan turned his head just briefly enough to make eye contact with the guard. And Ventress, who for whatever reason moved at a casual pace behind. He soared upward, gripping onto an exhaust pipe below the rounded glass dome of a restaurant, shocking the patrons looking down over Zara's governmental district. He burst forward, clinging to holds and ledges from the hanging buildings until he made it over the more accessible rooftops of the capital. His hands let go and he dropped, Cato Nemordia's fog making his hair and beard damp. His boots landed on the ledge of a building, and a second jump took him to the roof. Blaster bolts came from the direction of the government offices, the fire whizzing past him in scattered angles. Figuring out who shot at him and whether Ventress was involved required the luxury of time, something he didn't have thanks to a fleet of seeker remotes rising to his elevation. They propelled forward, and Obi-Wan set out on foot again, switching from Anakin's improvisation to his own specialty. He needed a plan.
Chapter 31. Rug Quanum.
As soon as she called out, "I'm on the target," things kicked into motion, and Rug knew exactly how Keitar would react even before the trigger was fully pulled. The cross-traffic of civilians gave cover to her story, though she hated the fact that they were potentially in the line of fire. And she was furious at Keitar for brandishing a pistol when terrified innocents stood in the way, government employees who had nothing to do with the investigation or any ongoing tensions with the Republic, political or otherwise. As for Obi-Wan, Rug had tracked enough targets to predict where they headed. This marked the first time such a target had Jedi abilities, but the same logic applied. An open window, plenty of options, an easy escape. Rug's job was to make it look good. Risk assessment was an inherent part of Nemordian culture, the counterpart to their inherent ability to calculate. Except in this case, the risk was whether or not she'd accidentally take down a Jedi. The odds clearly showed the path as the marked escape route, and the combination of Obi-Wan's current speed and what she'd witnessed mere moments ago created reasonable assumptions for her approach. All it took was a fraction of a second, a mix of practicality and instinct, and Rug sent the deadly bolt whizzing barely beneath Kenobi's feet as he vaulted up with a supernatural ascension. Even for an experienced sniper like herself, such execution caused her to exhale with relief.
"He was in your sights!"
Keitar yelled, and though she'd expected this outburst, she still acted with indignation at the way he lost his composure.
"Stand down, cadet!"
Rug matched Keitar's volume, well aware that everyone watched.
"Remember who is the veteran here!" "I don't care. You had the chance to kill the Jedi, and you didn't take it!"
He'd spent time with Ventress. That much had been clear, despite Rug trying to steer him away. Just days earlier, his grief seemed so overwhelming. And now he came up with evidence out of nowhere, without even informing his partner, and his urge to fight training droids had evolved into full-blown murder, despite civilian danger. Rug replayed the last few actions in her head, from the chase out into the hallway to the moment Obi-Wan vaulted upward. And through it all, he had moved swiftly and carefully around any civilians. That spoke volumes about the Jedi's integrity, and it gave her something to establish moral superiority in front of other Nemordian guards.
"Would you prefer me to rain blaster bolts on every innocent person in this hallway? Sacrifice them for whatever vengeance you seek?"
Keitar's scowl spoke just as much about what he was willing to do, and just how far someone or something had pushed him in such a short time. Rug cursed herself for not taking Ventress more seriously during their meeting while on guard duty.
this would avenge our dead.
The fact that Obi-Wan had communicated with one of his Jedi brethren hadn't surprised Rook. His analysis had to come from somewhere, and the equipment he brought certainly didn't seem powerful enough to run the computations and processes necessary to generate his findings. The data pad, however, was another story. He didn't deny it. He said he needed more time. And at the bar, he'd hesitated a few times when they talked about leads, like he was about to say something, then changed his mind. So while he did omit the truth, he likely ran his own risk assessment in doing so. Still, she was just as mad at him as she was at Kitar.
Kenobi was on to something. Ransacking his things impedes the investigation.
Ventress stepped in front of her, walking uncomfortably close given the circumstances.
Perhaps you have your own bias in this situation. I'd call it experience.
Experience? Or has guard duty softened your ability to make difficult judgments?
Ventress locked eyes with Kitar, her expression saying more to the young man than her words.
I thought you Neimoidians excelled at...
She took in a breath before turning back to Rook.
Risk assessment.
This agent of Count Dooku carried a sinister glint in her eyes, one that probably worked in intimidating many she encountered, possibly even the officials in the other room. And in the case of Kitar, it probably drew him to her. But Rook had seen far worse, done far worse, to let a few side-eyed glances scare her off.
I'm not playing your game,
she said in a firm tone and with a shake of the head before looking back out at the ledge. Kitar huffed, turning to the sky.
Where's that transport?
Calm chatter with the other guards revealed that Seekers pursued the Jedi, but Rook already knew that a handful of lightly armored aerial remotes wouldn't be able to stop someone with Obi-Wan's abilities. No, he must have had a plan and a purpose, and if he really did intend to try for a peaceful resolution, then he wouldn't be jumping on a shuttle to Coruscant. That meant that Rook needed to get to him first.
30 seconds inbound,
a voice from the remaining guards called out. Rook unlocked the side module on the rifle's handguard, then shifted it toward the base, activating a retraction of the elongated barrel. Inside the weapon, further mechanics churned for a quick second, switching internal plasma calibrations to work at closer range. She swung the rifle across her back, the strap holding tight to her armor. Kitar readied his pistol, things clicking into place as he replaced his ammo clip. Three other guards moved behind them, ready for the transport.
I'll take the next one,
Ventress said, giving space as the small floating platform came into view. Rook ignored anything and everything from Ventress as she stepped onto the windowsill, the drop below far enough that it came with an inherent trust as she stood next to Kitar. The octagonal platform slowed to a stop a step away from the open window, and Rook stepped aboard, the platform dipping under their weight. She grabbed the handrail to steady herself. Kitar did not, instead only looking up and pointing toward the direction where Obi-Wan had disappeared.
Chapter 32, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
The Seekers kept pace with Obi-Wan as he leapt from rooftop to rooftop, using the Force to help steady himself on harsh angles or slippery materials. Blaster bolts zoomed by him, the remotes failing to target with much accuracy, though Obi-Wan's ignited lightsaber made the occasional deflection. All of this bought time for options. A stalling technique rather than pure escape. His ship had been confiscated, though jetting off would send the wrong message right now anyway, the appearance of guilt when he wanted discussion.
He had no means of communication with Anakin, and while he often disagreed with his former Padawan, sometimes the mere act of debate and counter-arguments produced a solution. And running indefinitely wouldn't help anyone. As he moved, he scanned the area and considered his priorities. The most important thing remained getting an audience with the Trade Federation. And though they already leaned toward not believing him, it marked another chance to plead for de-escalation. And given that Neimoidian culture made trials public, recordings of his arguments would likely make it out across the galaxy. Broadcasting a message to slow down and think, rather than play into any hands that wanted rapid conflict. Barring any of that, he still needed to find a way to escape. The last time he'd been in a similar situation, captured, isolated, and with few options, the best idea hadn't come from himself or Anakin. Instead, Padme demonstrated a level of forward thinking that bested the Jedi, using a hairpin to quickly undo her shackles while master and apprentice bickered. She'd likely been thinking about how to escape from the moment the Geonosian guards hauled them into the arena and the beasts emerged from their gates. That provided all the time needed to execute her plan. Obi-Wan didn't have a lockpick, but he did have a lightsaber. One that guards would take away the moment they caught him. That made safeguarding it key. And given that he was being chased, protecting it became the current objective. He turned a corner as shouts from below echoed upward. The pulsing hum of hover platforms grew louder and louder, each with a number of guards on it. The seekers elevated, likely to give the guards better line of sight, and Obi-Wan considered the spaces around him. Several buildings reached skyward, and above those hung another block of the bridge city, structures built downward in an arch that aided in his escape. Overpasses connected some of these, enabling foot traffic in all directions. Directly below one of those, in fact, sat the open courtyard for public trials. And above that, an elaborate tower, something that appeared too thin to actually offer any public functionality. Still, it looked ornate, curves and reflective glass embedded into an architectural marvel. An idea emerged in Obi-Wan's mind as he recalled a wall where he'd found data chips hidden by a Jedi long ago on the planet Linara. He turned, changing the angle of his sprint to move toward the tower. More voices shouted, calls for guards to close in on him from all angles. Obi-Wan tapped into the currents of the Force, feeling the burst of energy rippling through his body as it elevated him halfway up the tower, well out of the sight lines of the approaching guards. With several seconds of cover, he found a small cutout beneath a window ledge, something that seemed more decorative than functional. His hand and footholds maintained, he grabbed his lightsaber from his belt, then flipped it upside down and jammed it against the wall. The blade activated, now an elongated energy knife, digging directly into the side of the structure. And as he jostled the hilt to clear a radius, melted ore oozed out. The weapon went quiet, its blade retracting without ever being visible after carving a space just deep enough to keep a small object secure from prying eyes, like a lightsaber hilt. The weapon lodged and hidden, Obi-Wan once again launched himself with the Force, propelling forward as if the tower had merely been a tool for his escape rather than a hiding place for his lightsaber. He landed on an adjacent parapet, civilian observers ducking in fear at his appearance. He swerved around them, then resumed running, though this time he purposefully let his speed dip. A floating platform of guards approached in the distance, along with two behind him. He hesitated, more for appearance than anything else, his search for places to turn simply a way to burn off the seconds until capture.
two Seekers emerged, elevating before jetting forward, and though Obi-Wan no longer had his lightsaber to deflect blaster fire, he held up both hands and reached through the Force to grip the machines and smash them into each other. Their crumpled chassis dropped, a trail of spark and smoke left in their wake. The action provided good cover for his true intentions, a show of defense that masked the fact that he intended to be captured. Behind him, boots slammed on the stone path, followed by several shouts, all melting together into a verbal mix of aggression. "Cover me!" Rug yelled, and Obi-Wan turned to see her sprinting toward him, a pistol drawn out while her usual rifle sat across her back. A line of guards formed behind her, with rifles aimed directly at Obi-Wan. On the other side, the farther guards landed and mirrored the formation. Obi-Wan put his hands up, then glanced upward at the tower. A quick flick of the Force to feel that his lightsaber remained secure in its spot.
"Don't move, Jedi!"
Rug yelled, and though her volume increased, her voice carried a level tone. She slowed her approach, pistol trained on him as she got closer.
"Hands behind your back,"
she said, her voice low enough that he barely heard it over the altitude's winds and the humming repulsors of the floating guard platforms.
"I appreciate what you did in the hallway," Obi-Wan said without resistance.
Rug holstered her pistol and pulled out a pair of energy shackles. She moved without speaking, first binding Obi-Wan's left hand, then the right.
"Why didn't you tell me about the datapad? I needed to know whether it was authentic or not."
The binders clicked into place, a pressure now gripping Obi-Wan's wrists.
"If you wanted me to trust you," she said, "you should have been honest with me."
A low hum vibrated from the shackles, the frequency of their energy subtle enough that perhaps only he picked up on it.
"You're right. I apologize for that."
"No, laser sword," Rug said, lowering her voice even further as the guards approached.
"I'm improvising. Listen."
Obi-Wan relaxed, shifting into a defeated posture, clear enough for others to see.
"Yes, the datapad points to the Republic, but we don't know why yet. Presenting it as fact without context could escalate things beyond repair. I need a chance." "They sound like they've made up their minds."
"A chance is not a guarantee," Obi-Wan said over his shoulder.
"Nothing is absolute, except for not taking that chance."
"Well then," Rug patted him on the back,
"I'll do my best to help."
"You!"
Kedar called, the single word practically a taunt, and though every rifle from the armed guards pointed at him, the young Neimoidian clearly moved at a step from the group. A tension rippled through Obi-Wan's body, and he reached out, dipping into the currents of the Force to sense whether Kedar was close to pulling the trigger.
"Did you really think your tricks could help you escape?"
"Stand down, Kedar. He is under arrest. I have apprehended him."
"No."
Kedar moved forward, stepping into Obi-Wan's peripheral vision. But Rug moved to block him, her shoulders now nearly touching his.
"He is a prisoner. He will stand trial in the royal court of Cato Neimoidia. Your job here is done."
"She is correct,"
Ventress said, appearing from behind the row of guards. She pulled back her hood, though her cloak remained wrapped around her as she walked forward.
"The Jedi will submit. It is what they do. But I do have one question for you."
Ventress extended a pale finger at Rug.
"Where is his lightsaber?"
To this point, Obi-Wan had placed his faith in Rug, starting with their initial encounter on the surface of Cato Neimoidia and continuing all the way to her intentionally ill-timed shot in the hallway. Now he waited for something more subtle,
than anything involving blaster fire. What would Rug say about his weapon?
Damaged, possibly destroyed. If you check the surrounding grounds, you will likely find its remains, Obi-Wan said, giving Rug a lead to work with. Your seekers shot it out of my hand.
Damaged, possibly destroyed. What kind of Jedi are you if mere remotes can destroy your weapon? I thought you were a Jedi Master.
Being chased by guards and seekers at high altitude is not part of standard Jedi training.
Ventress clicked her tongue as she began pacing around him. Quite convenient, if you think about it.
I can confirm, Rug said, moving to step closer to Ventress. I saw it happen. You can check the holo security recording, though it happened up there.
She gestured to the tall adjacent tower. I'm not sure the cams have the angle.
Are you certain that is what you saw? And you are not under the influence of a Jedi mind trick? Only the strong can resist that.
The two nearly collided in front of Obi-Wan, Ventress staring Rug down. But Rug's orange-red eyes never blinked, never lost focus in a way that shouldn't have surprised him. Someone with possibly decades of commando experience likely couldn't be intimidated. Especially someone with a strong moral compass.
I'm certain, Rug said, taking a step forward until she was nearly face to face with Ventress. Check the security recording.
They stood, only the wind swirling between them as everyone held their positions, the guards, Kitar, and Obi-Wan. He watched, the only movement between the two women coming from the rhythm of their breathing. Ventress looked Rug up and down, then eyed Obi-Wan without turning.
As a representative of the Confederacy of Independent Systems, do you have a problem with what I've done?
Rug finally asked.
I trust your judgment, Ventress said slowly.
She took several steps back, arms out, then walked up to Obi-Wan, just as guard rifles nudged him to move. She leaned in close and spoke directly in his ear.
I was pleased to see your work up close, Master Kenobi.
She reached up and tousled the long locks of hair dangling over his neck.
Count Dooku was right. You're quite impressive.
Chapter 33. Anakin Skywalker.
The Noriker's console beeped again, and yet again Anakin chose to ignore it.
Shouldn't you check that?
Mill asked.
It's beeped 6 times now.
7 times, actually. The first time Mill had been in the back trying to learn how to speak astromech with R2-D2. They tunneled through hyperspace, the swirling bright mix of blue and white flashing over the cockpit. Going through hyperspace in a small freighter with questionable integrity made for a completely different experience for the youngling. And though Anakin relished feeling the rattle of the deck plates and the rumble of the propulsion systems, the difference between official Republic equipment and the way everyone else lived caught Mill off guard.
It's nothing, Anakin said.
Beeping usually indicates something.
Mill leaned forward over Anakin's shoulder and squinted.
Bad, right?
In this case, it was bad. But not bad like mechanical failure or low fuel. This was a comm signal, and though Anakin wouldn't know who it was exactly until he opened the channel, he had a sneaking suspicion that it came from a clone commander.
That was the problem with making it up as you went along. Most of the practical logistics simply never came up. Obi-Wan had plans built upon strategies, built upon guidelines, even when he had to come up with something on the fly.
Padme worked much in the same way. And Chancellor Palpatine, well, he wouldn't have gotten to where he was today if he hadn't set up his plans in advance. The three most important people in Anakin's life all worked efficiently and methodically. And then there was him, like the sun at the center of that solar system, pulling them all out of balance with his impulse-driven decisions. Padme never gave him grief about it, but he started to recognize what her half-smiles meant when an idea popped into his head. Obi-Wan, on the other hand, always made a comment at the end. It usually came as a 1-2 punch, the first hit being a scold for not listening, the second being astonishment for Anakin pulling off whatever little miracle he'd attempted. And on very rare occasions, Obi-Wan would follow that with a bit of gratitude. "Bad is relative," Anakin said.
"Is this something I'll learn as a Padawan?"
"Not likely. How much pilot training do you have?" Mill's head tilted, and she raised one eyebrow. "Okay, fair point. Well, every control panel is different, but there are a lot of similarities." The beeping started again, a simple red light flashing over the navigational chart. "Like that particular beeping light? That's someone trying to reach us over the ship's comms."
"Someone? You mean..."
"Most likely," Anakin said. "It makes sense. I mean, the 302nd and Durbin weren't exactly going to ignore that we didn't come back."
"I thought you took care of that."
I may have skipped that part of my plan." "Hey," Anakin said, pointing at her with a laugh. "You were supposed to go back to the cruiser. I just made up the rest as I went along. They must have figured out who we bartered with and gotten the ship's comm codes."
"So maybe just tell them what we're doing. The clones listen to you."
That was true. Ever since attaining the rank of Jedi Knight, the clones had fallen into place. And even if Durbin was involved, perhaps some blustery vague talk could temporarily smooth it over. "Okay," Anakin said. "Let's try it your way." He clicked the flashing button, and a small beam shot up above the console, the holographic image forming into existence. Anakin's hopes lay with Theo, Raptor, or Sparks, but a worst-case scenario of an annoyed Durbin when heard was doable. What he got, though, moved the needle beyond worst-case scenario.
"Skywalker,"
the voice said with a familiar disdain before the image fully assembled.
"Where are you?"
"Master Windu,"
Mills said with a gasp. Anakin resisted his urge to roll his eyes.
"Master Windu?"
Anakin kept his tone flat and diplomatic, the typical default he reverted to whenever talking to any Jedi, even Obi-Wan, though their last few conversations felt like they'd started to evolve past that.
"I'm sorry, your transmission broke up." "Skywalker, repeat your destination."
Which he couldn't reveal. He couldn't even play coy with it. The smallest hint would likely push the Council towards suspecting his destination. With Obi-Wan in a dangerous situation, and any word of Republic involvement likely to dial tensions up even further, the Senate, Chancellor, and Jedi all had to stay out of this. Not just for Obi-Wan's sake, for the sake of a war that threatened to spiral out of control. He needed to think fast. "We're on our way to..." He let his words fade out while he rotated the small knob for the comm's frequency stabilizer. "There's a lot of interference right now. Ion storms. But I have the youngling Mill Alabeth with me. She's safe. I'll check in as soon as we land." "What was that?" Anakin twisted the knob again, static interrupting the signal and causing lines to jab in and out of Mace's hologram. Over his shoulder, Mill laughed, and Anakin turned to shoot her a be quiet glance, not out of scolding, but to keep up appearances. But they locked eyes,
and her grin became infectious, so much so that he put his gloved hand over his mouth to prevent his near laugh from transmitting across the galaxy to the Jedi Order's most revered fighter. Because even though Anakin excelled at improvising under duress, that applied only to combat situations. In this case, his actions came off as no more than a childhood prank on the Jedi's most powerful warrior, which was pretty funny in itself.
Repeat your destination.
Understood, Master.
He let go of the knob and the transmission stabilized. I have the youngling Mil Alabeth with me. She is safe. Please send my apologies to the 302nd and Durbin when heard. We got pulled away after discovering an urgent issue on Langston, and this ship's comms aren't stable.
Skywalker, where are you going?
Mace Windu always spoke with quiet intensity, but now, the venerable Jedi Master's frustration manifested into an emerging growl. In all of the challenges that Mace had faced down recently, from taking down Jango Fett with a single lightsaber swipe, to staring down an overwhelming wave of super battle droids on Dantooine, he'd done so with such calm and control. And yet here, a simple calm trick managed to get under his skin. Anakin gave himself a silent pat on the back. He'd definitely have to tell Padme about this, assuming they all survived.
Commander Theo,
Mace said to a clone off cam,
get me a tracking lock on this transmission.
Right away, sir,
the clone responded.
We're hitting a huge ion storm now. I will check in as soon as I...
Anakin cut off the transmission there, Mace's burning eyes and tight scowl suddenly disappearing. For several seconds, the only sound in the ship came from the frequent rattling of deck plates, a regular tink-tink-tink that tapped an almost musical pattern as the ship flew through the brilliant tunnel of hyperspace. Finally, Mil broke the silence.
Well,
she said. Anakin looked up to see the whites of lightspeed reflecting off her tan cheeks and pale horns.
That didn't go good.
Don't worry, Anakin said. You're not in trouble. If anything, I'm going to be the one in trouble.
But that's all right.
The panel showed the Nava computer's flight path to Cato Neimoidia, about half a day's journey left, though possibly longer, given that the shuttle might fly apart at any minute. I'm used to it. R2-D2 rolled in behind them, whistling a lecture at him. Takes one to know one, R2. The droid whistled in return before swiveling its head and looking at Mil.
Are assignments always like this?
Mil asked as she settled into the passenger seat.
I don't know,
Anakin said. He leaned back into his seat, the torn leather crinkling as he sank into the worn padding. I've only been a Jedi Knight for a short time. R2? R2-D2 beeped, this time without the sass. Show us everything you know about Cato Neimoidia. An affirmative series of chirps came through, followed by a hollow projection of the planet. The console beeped again, an incoming transmission that Anakin didn't dare answer. He reached over to mute it, and as he did, he noticed some of Langston's blue sand was still stuck in the straps of his glove. Sand. It got everywhere. The beeping continued. Anakin could only assume that it was Master Windu, who had more than enough patience to keep this up for the entire duration of their journey. But even if he realized their ultimate destination as Cato Neimoidia, the Council would abide by mission parameters and avoid any confrontations. That was the difference between them and Anakin. Anakin smirked at such a thought. He clicked the button to the left of the flashing indicator, setting the Norker's incoming transmissions to silent for now. Consequences could be dealt with upon returning to Coruscant. But with Master Windu already irritated, they'd better save Obi-Wan, because if they came back empty-handed, it might be worse than losing his arm.
Chapter 34, Obi-Wan Kenobi. Four plain, smooth walls surrounded Obi-Wan, lacking the opulence of most of Cato Ne Moidia's other architecture. Microlights must have been embedded within the top of the wall, providing an ambient illumination to the green-gray holding cell, and the door itself appeared to be a simple metal slab with a locking mechanism, probably something capable of withstanding significant brute force or blaster fire. Not that Obi-Wan had any intentions of escaping. He'd been in far worse situations, and in every case, a solution presented itself. Even that nest of Gundarks, though he'd had Anakin with him then. That harrowing escape had been filled with claws and teeth, dirt and chaos, yet once they'd stopped arguing about who went first, Obi-Wan and Anakin had fought and moved effortlessly on their way out. Equal parts collaboration and single fighting unit. Even when Anakin was younger, they moved in sync, as if their verbal jousting was a necessary part of their relationship, balancing their natural instincts for combat. But now nothing tethered them. The very mission came with the order of isolation. Every step here kept him alone by design, and even when he had the choice, he chose to keep Anakin at arm's length. The thing was, every single time he tried to keep Anakin away, he found a way in. That was simply who Anakin Skywalker was. Years ago, when Anakin was still early in his Padawan time, Obi-Wan had been assigned a minor investigation to a dead star system, something so ancient that the remaining dwarf lingered at near absolute zero temperatures. He'd intended to fly there alone despite his discomfort about piloting himself due to the strange quantum fluctuations and gravity wells. But halfway through the hyperspace journey, he'd heard the strangest noise coming from beneath one of the panels by the portside thruster. Snoring. Obi-Wan had lifted the metal access panel, only to find 12-year-old Anakin stowed away, having fallen asleep in the warm ambience and rumbling metal above the sublight drive, the heat reminding him of a Tatooine evening. "I didn't want to stay at the temple," he'd said before explaining his elaborate plan to hide on board. "Besides, you said you promised Master Qui-Gon you'd protect me." Which he had. "Since you're here," Obi-Wan had told him with a sigh, "you might as well take a look." And when they'd arrived at their destination, he'd taken it as an opportunity. The rare privilege of viewing such a scientific impossibility, doubling as a good reminder of the Jedi code regarding attachment and letting go. A lesson that over time, even stars burned out. Out there, in the most lifeless regions of space, Anakin had simply found a way to find him. Obi-Wan and Anakin. Anakin and Obi-Wan. The mentor who took careful, measured steps. The Padawan who charged forward with explosive power and, it seemed, ridiculous luck. Despite their age difference, despite their rank difference, despite their personality difference, they always got the job done. But that was under the guise of master and apprentice. This time was different. They were equals now, their link purposefully broken. Too many gears turned in the galaxy right now, and everyone in the Republic slotted into a specific purpose to help end the war. They had responsibilities, and the mission depended on them staying apart. Obi-Wan laughed at the mysterious twists and turns of the Force. Their first time truly apart. Not as easy as one off to a remote system while the other handled tasks on Coruscant, but pulled in completely different directions. And of course,
every plan that he tried to conjure up came with the caveat of, if only Anakin were here. If only Anakin could discover more about Ventress, or tap into the Nemoidian public broadcast system to provide more context to the masses, or help Rug out with her lead, or investigate further, finding some possible way to identify a falsehood about the data pad. That was what Anakin did. Find a way. They didn't even need to directly attack the situation together, but Anakin's resourcefulness, stubbornness, impulsiveness, his sheer Anakin-ness felt necessary at this point. Without it, Obi-Wan may as well have been flying blind or missing a limb, or in this case, possibly damning the Republic to consequences too great to contemplate, while dishonoring the memory of thousands of dead from Cad Assura, and quite possibly making himself complicit in the whole thing. All because he did this without Anakin, without the constant pushing and reining in of each other's boundaries. And Obi-Wan wondered if Qui-Gon had foreseen all of this. Not just his own loss at the hands of the vicious Sith Lord on Naboo, but the fact that Qui-Gon would forever tie two opposing forces together, their partnership always edging towards spinning out of control, but always, always finding a way to make a happy landing. It took not having that intrinsic link to Anakin for Obi-Wan to finally see how much they